You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 4th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
NATO was founded on the single solemn promise, an attack on one ally is an attack on all. From that foundation, we have built the most powerful and successful alliance in history.
As NATO celebrates its 75th anniversary, we'll ask about the future of the military alliance. The Philippines Navy say it's preparing for the worst possible scenario in terms of countering China's escalating aggression. We'll unpack just exactly what that might mean. As the civilian death toll continues to rise in Gaza, both Washington and Westminster are coming under increasing pressure to stop arms sales to Israel. We'll examine the likelihood and the ramifications. Then...
If you think about buildings as a place to bring people together and create interactions, sociability, happiness, productivity, I think those are quite fundamental.
We'll hear from experts at McKinsey about the future of our urban environment. We'll get the latest economy and trade news, have a hit of headlines from the world's front pages, and we'll end the show looking back at the life of the Queen of Caribbean Literature, Marisa Conde, Guadeloupe's grand storyteller, who's died aged 90. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Russian drones hit high-rise apartment blocks and private homes early this morning in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, killing at least four people. Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz has called for early elections, piling pressure on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his increasingly unpopular right-wing coalition. And the number of people injured in Wednesday's 7.2 magnitude earthquake in eastern Taiwan has now climbed past 1,000. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. But first...
As we face a more dangerous world, the bond between Europe and North America has never been more important. As we prepare for an historic summit in Washington, NATO will continue to support Ukraine, will continue to strengthen our alliance, and will continue to work with our partners across the globe for peace and security.
Today, April the 4th, marks the 75th anniversary of the founding of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Since yesterday, foreign ministers have been gathering at NATO headquarters in Brussels for a two-day meeting to mark the anniversary and to prepare for the upcoming Washington summit in July. The gathering and July's summit are seen as crucial opportunities for allies and partners to reinforce the alliance's unity, strength and resolve for the years to come, as the world faces a new and unprecedented era of strategic competition. Well, I'm joined now from Brussels by Benedetta Berti, who's the head of policy planning in the office of the Secretary General at NATO. Benedetta, we're thrilled to have you on the show. Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General, made some public remarks before the start of the meeting in Brussels. We heard a snatch of that a few moments ago. What else did he say?
Good morning, and it's great to be speaking. Well, the Secretary General yesterday addressed the press on the first day of our two-day forum ministerial and essentially laid out what the agenda is. And as you said, this is an important milestone for the alliance, not just because, of course, we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of NATO, but also because ministers are meeting to prepare the Washington summit that will take place in July. Specifically, that means discussing crucial issues like how to increase and strengthen NATO support to Ukraine, and planning, and ministers agreed to start looking into what additional step NATO may consider in terms of coordination of assistance and training support to Ukraine. Here, the main message, of course, is how do we put support for Ukraine on a long-term, sustainable and sustained footing so that Ukraine can exercise its right to self-defense, and so that we convincingly and emphatically communicate to Moscow that they cannot wear us out in terms of our resolve to continue supporting Ukraine. So that's going to be, that's been an important issue on the agenda for this foreign ministerial. Today, just in a couple of hours, ministers will meet in the NATO Ukraine Council format with Minister Kuleba again to discuss Ukraine's short and long-term needs, and to also look at the progress that Ukraine is making in terms of reforms, again, coming closer to NATO politically and militarily. Mm. And then in the afternoon, we will also have a meeting with our Indo-Pacific partners, again, to signal the importance of looking at security through that global lens.
So we know that obviously NATO's recently expanded, and this is Sweden's first meeting as a full NATO member. What does the country bring to the alliance in terms of defence capability?
Right. So indeed, this was yet another reason why yesterday and today are a momentous occasion for us, is because, of course, this is the first foreign ministerial meeting with Sweden sits as a full NATO ally. I think with Sweden and Finland joining the alliance, we gain two highly capable militarily allies. We were already cooperating with NATO very, very closely previously as partners. So there is a really seamless transition here in terms of interoperability, ability to work together. But of course, with Sweden and Finland, we also have for the first time all of our Scandinavian allies under the NATO umbrella. And this, of course, strengthens the defense of Northern Europe. It becomes all under secure areas of responsibility. In addition, I would say with both Finland and Sweden, we gain a lot in terms of understanding and addressing resilience and how to build resilience with our populations. So overall, as the Secretary General always says, this makes NATO stronger and Sweden and Finland safer. So mm-hmm. It's really a good development for the alliance.
So we know that the USA has always been key to the alliance. As you said, North America is very important, but we also know that Donald Trump is no fan. In light of Trump's possible return to power in Washington, how can NATO Trump-proof for the future?
Well, I would say that for us, regardless of who would win the presidential elections, the United States is and will remain a strong and committed NATO ally. And that's very important to reiterate. And this is the case and will remain the case, because a strong transatlantic alliance and a strong NATO is in the United States' vital national interest. Just like it is in the vital national interest of all allies. But there are some things that we need to do anyways, and I think that's what we're going to focus on. And one of them, unsurprisingly, is how do we continue to improve when it comes to burden sharing? How do we keep improving when it comes to, especially from European allies in Canada, to spend more on defense? And of course, here we are on a very positive trajectory, going from only three allies spending 2% just a decade ago to now two-thirds of the alliance projected to spend the famous 2% of their total GDP in defense. So I think that's a very important element of how do you build a future-proof alliance, continue to invest in defense. Similarly, also the work we're doing to contribute to energize our defense industrial base on a transatlantic level, so on both sides of the Atlantic, this remains crucial and will remain crucial regardless, again, who wins the presidential elections. And finally, I would say that the work we're doing to really prepare for a world of strategic competition, so increasing our work on resilience, countering disinformation and malign interference, I would say all of that is also incredibly relevant, again, regardless of the shifting political winds. So I think we're just building a stronger alliance based on the fact that we live in a more dangerous security environment.
Mm. And I mean, at the alliance's creation, of course, that was in the aftermath of the Second World War. It was intended to serve three purposes: deterring Soviet expansionism, forbidding the revival of nationalist militarism in Europe through a strong North American presence on the continent, and encouraging European political integration, all of those things, if you swap out Soviet for Russia, are still continuing. How are those aims still relevant, and how will you adapt to fit this current global situation?
Right. So I think that's a really good point. And firstly, when it comes to deterring conflict, preventing conflict on for allies, that remains the main purpose, of course, of NATO, and through enabling our collective defense. And just like, as you said, of course, now there has been, unfortunately, a series of very, very negative developments that has led us to identify the Russian Federation as the most direct and strategic threat to the alliance. So we are definitely, that has led to a robust reset of our deterrence and defense posture that started, I would say, around 10 years ago, following Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, and is still continuing to this day. But of course, I would say today we're in a much stronger position in terms of having a credible deterrence and defense. So that's going to be part and parcel of how we continue to adapt. At the same time, and as you mentioned, NATO is also a political organization, and it's always been about fostering transatlantic convergence to deal with shared challenges to our security. And that was the Soviet Union in the past, that is the Russian threat today, but it's not just Russia. Today, we really also focus on countering and protecting ourselves against the threat of terrorism. And more, we're also looking at challenges, including from the PRC, which is for us a systemic, a strategic competitor. So I think NATO is remaining absolutely faithful to his mandate of ensuring collective defense, but we're doing it in a world in which really we need to simultaneously prepare for multiple challenges across domains and theaters. So I think that's very much our driving principle, and has been for the past few years.
Benedetta, thank you very much indeed. That's Benedetta Berti from NATO there. And this is The Globalist. It is 14:11 in Manila, 7:11 here in London. The Philippines and China have had a series of maritime run-ins that have triggered concern about an escalation at sea. China claims almost the entire South China Sea as its territory. It's policed by an armada of Coast Guard vessels, some more than 1,000 kilometres from its mainland. The Philippines National Security Council emphasises the need to exhaust all diplomatic measures to resolve the issues, but a senior officer says the Navy is prepared for the worst-case scenario. Well, I'm joined now from Manila by Richard Hedarin, who's an academic and a columnist for the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Richard, it's lovely to have you back on the show. The current argument concerns resupply of the BRP Sierra Madre. That's the grounded ship on the second Thomas Shoal. It's been there since 1999. Can you just give us some background on that?
Well, as you may know, the second Thomas Shoal, or called Ayungin Shoal in the Philippines, is a low tide elevation. So it's not an island or rock capable of generating its own maritime zones. It's not a territory to be claimed. So legally speaking, it's an extension of the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. And this was confirmed by the arbitration award under the United Nations Convention of the Sea in 2016. Now, back in the 1990s, you know, the Philippines was a traumatized country. The American bases had just left earlier in the decade, and the Chinese, just a few years later on, seized the Philippine claimed Mischief Reef, which is also within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. So in a desperate effort to make sure that the situation doesn't further deteriorate, because the Philippines back then really didn't have much of the capabilities on its own, it essentially what it did was it grounded a World War II vessel, BRP Sierra Madre, and then placed a number of Marines there to guard the area, because they were very fearful the Chinese will move into that area. So from 1999 onwards, that, you know, rusty, tetanus-friendly kind of a grounded vessel has served as our de facto base in the area to protect that low tide elevation. But the reality is that over time, it was giving way. It was giving in to the elements. And there were fears that, by end of the 2010s, it was just going to collapse on its own. So the Philippines was looking at efforts not only to resupply the Marine troops there, but also to fortify that that ship. I mean, maybe the outside doesn't look as good, but the inside may have perhaps better internet nowadays because of those fortification efforts. But China allegedly made a gentleman's agreement, a secret deal with the former president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, very pro-China, very anti-Western leader. And according to that deal, the Philippines was not supposed to fortify our de facto base in the area. And that is now a bone of contention. China is saying, we made an agreement and now we're violating that by resupplying our Marines there on a more regular basis, but more importantly, fortifying that feature. The Philippines maintains, including current President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., that no such deal was made. And if ever it were made, it is not binding. It was just a secret deal, a gentleman's agreement deal. And to be honest, right now, there are openly questions about whether a treasonous act was committed by the former administration, and therefore investigations should proceed in that regard.
And so just looking at these remarks by the Navy official, he talks about the worst case scenario. What would that be?
Well, I think we're you know, honestly, there is, of course, the threat of unwanted escalation because, you know, for a long time, China has been relying on a so-called gray zone strategy, meaning using its militia, non-lethal force to intimidate its smaller neighbors. But the most recent event, the water cannon event, the third in just a few months, was almost lethal because, you know, when the pressure of the water is just so strong, you know, if it hits someone directly or that person hits something else, like a metal or something, it could be actually lethal and multiple Filipino servicemen were injured. So obviously, you know, there are many in the Philippines who want to do something more aggressively. And at the same time, the Chinese are warning that this could be just the beginning of something even scarier. And that's why the Philippines and the United States have been having some serious discussion on whether the Philippines should invoke its mutual defense treaty with the Americans. But in my opinion, it's also important not to be alarmist. I think China is trying to engage in a psychological warfare. It's trying to impose its will. But China also is worried that the United States may be dragged into this conflict. And that is not going to end up well for anyone, for that matter. And as far as the Philippines is concerned, I mean, a lot of these incidents involved Philippine military, I don't know, hiring some private small boat to do the resupply mission so that it doesn't look too provocative. But it's not like the Philippines doesn't have its own warships. And the Philippines is also exploring joint patrols, if not joint resupply missions, with some of its allies and friends in the area. So I think there are a whole range of options still available for the Philippines in order to make sure that it stands its ground and China will be forced to eventually recognize that the Philippines is not a pushover.
You mentioned the mutual defense treaty. That was signed back in the 50s. Just tell us more about that. Is it likely that the Philippines might invoke it? And would the U.S. then come to its aid?
Yeah, absolutely. So the 1951 mutual defense treaty, that came on the heels of the end of World War II and the San Francisco Treaty, among others. And back then, the Philippines did not control a lot of these land features that it currently controls. And back then, to be honest, barely anyone controlled. The Imperial Japanese forces, which had occupied those areas in the Second World War, had disoccupied them, have moved out of that. So the understanding of the Americans is that the mutual defense treaty applies to, you know, the archipelagic territories of the Philippines proper, not necessarily the areas that it claims. The Philippines maintains that, you know, since the Spanish era and before, the Filipinos have been exercising all sorts of controls, administrative, historical control over a lot of these land features. And later on, of course, when the United Nations Convention of the Sea was being negotiated, the Philippines was also claiming a lot of this feature as an extension of its exclusive economic zone. So you had for half a century, you had this kind of a surreal situation where the Philippines would push its claim and then the Americans would equivocate. In fact, the Americans had this so-called strategic ambiguity strategy from the Nixon administration all the way to the Obama administration. And things only changed during the Trump administration, particularly in 2019, when the American Secretary of State back then, Pompeo, in it, visited Manila and said, you know, the mutual defense treaty will apply to any attack on Philippine troops, vessels, and aircrafts in the South China Sea. And by extension, that will apply to Filipino troops positioned on some of these disputed land features like the Ayungin Shoal and Second Thomas Shoal. So it has been a kind of a jiu-jitsu between the Philippines and its ally for quite some time. And I think the Americans realized that their strategic ambiguity approach is more ambiguous than strategic because China read that as essentially Americans staying away. And once China realized that it can impose its will, it proceeded. But now I think America is realizing that in the end, this could end up bad for everyone because you don't want the South China Sea to become a Chinese lake.
Now, we know that China is a hugely important trading partner with the Philippines. And I just wonder how the economic and political relationships balance out in the end, in the event of a threatened worst case scenario. What would happen to trade?
Well, I mean, that's the thing you can say about any country, right? I mean, China is also a major trading partner of the United States. But the reality is, as far as the Philippines is concerned, among its neighbors, it's the least dependent country on China. And to be honest, I think China is perhaps even more dependent on the Philippines. We're a massive export market for them in the region. We import way more from China, than exporting to China. And a lot of products we import from China, probably you can import it from elsewhere, including from Vietnam and some of our other neighbors. And, you know, the Philippines also exports a lot of rare earth materials and nickel and very important minerals that China needs for some of its high-end productions. So honestly, in the Philippines, some of the conversation is whether the Philippines should also leverage some of its export materials to China if ever China wants to escalate the situation. And let's not forget, China has been intimidating many countries in the region, particularly Australia, in recent years with economic sanctions, and eventually it relented. You know, there's this history whereby China imposes its will when you allow it to impose its will. But if you stand your ground, as the Australians have done in recent years, as the Vietnamese have done for 1,000 years, and to a lesser degree in the case of Indonesia and Malaysia in their own disputes with China, China eventually blinks. Not forever, but at least it's willing to reluctantly respect you if you are willing to respect yourself and stand your ground. And because we had 6 years of Duterte, who essentially acted as China's proxy, I think the Chinese are still struggling to accept the new reality in the Philippines, which is, hey, we also have our own national dignity and we're going to fight for our sovereign rights. And that's why we are in this very dangerous chicken game we see right now in the South China Sea.
Richard, thank you very much indeed. That's Richard Hedarin. Now, still to come in the programme, as developers continue to work to bring people back into city centres, we hear the approach of global consultancy firm McKinsey.
One of my clients has this phrase around sort of earning the commute. I really like that. What do I need to do to persuade people it's worth spending half an hour, even an hour and a half to come into this space, and what are they going to get from it? And it's elevated the thinking from real estate just being a cost to being actually a key lever of business productivity and business performance.
This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. The time now in London is 7:23, and we're going to continue with today's newspapers. Joining me here in the studio is correspondent and campaigner Catherine Carpenter. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you very much, Georgina. Good to be here.
I think it's the first time you've done this show.
It is. I'm very honoured.
So are we. And very interested to get your take on one of the stories we've been reporting in our headlines today, which is this Russian drone attack on Kharkiv that happened overnight. Reuters is reporting it, but it's now popping up all over the place. What's the detail on that?
Yeah, I think... Given the sort of coverage, wall-to-wall coverage today of the NATO alliance anniversary and the importance of kind of its role in this unstable world, and then you've got this incident overnight in Kharkiv really kind of pointing to one of the situations that's been so ongoing. So there was a drone attack last night on a high-rise apartment block and some private houses, and we know that four people were killed. Now, one of those was an aid worker who had gone to respond to the first incident and then was hit in a second strike. And of course, the kind of grave danger that aid workers put themselves in all over the world has been highlighted so much this week with the separate incident in Gaza. So that's what we know at the moment. And of course, yesterday, Finland became the latest NATO country to sign its security deal with Ukraine. President Zelensky saying Russia's planning to mobilise 300,000 extra troops by June, so trying to kind of up the rhetoric there. And then overnight, this awful drone attack, again shedding light on the role of aid workers as well.
Mm. And there's a lot of concern in Ukraine that city districts could be hit by power cuts. Russia seems to be targeting electrical infrastructure.
Yes, that's definitely been the way things have been happening recently. I mean, we know that this is often a tactic used in conflict. And yeah, President Zelensky highlighting that too.
Mm. I think what's really interesting, looking at this coverage and coverage too of what's happening in Gaza, less so in Gaza because we're not getting quite so much footage, but that these are conflicts that we can watch actually physically ourselves from thousands of miles away.
Yeah, it's unusual, isn't it? I mean, it's just the way the world has shifted now. And I mean, in Gaza, we get that view in one respect. And yet, on the other hand, of course, journalists not being allowed in to give those eyewitness accounts, which are so important for kind of balance and getting the whole story. So in some ways, on social media, etc., you might get pictures like we've seen of that aid convoy. But then on the other hand, you're not getting the eyewitness accounts from journalists.
Mm. Let's go to Japan now and the Japan Times with this extraordinary story about a man arrested over death threats to Nintendo.
Yeah, I picked this up because I thought it was interesting that this had been happening. I'd never heard about it. Apparently, a 27-year-old man has been arrested for sending death threats to the games company Nintendo, as you say. According to the Japanese Times, he had confessed to sending 39 messages via online inquiry forms on the company's website, threatening to kill people at a gaming tournament and other events that Nintendo was hosting. And of course, these events then had to be kind of postponed or cancelled altogether. And the company saying that's sort of had a big kind of financial impact on it. But an interesting one. The gamers amongst your listeners may be aware of some of these events being cancelled because, they are really quite a big deal.
Yeah. And no idea why he was moved to do this.
No, I mean, apparently, according to Kenta, the reports, he worked in a local zoo. And I think the sort of inference is that it was some sort of, malicious communication. But obviously, that's being investigated now.
Well, another investigation going on, this time in Le Havre. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, the Le Monde and Politico have been reporting that Le Havre Town Hall in France, obviously, has been raided by police as part of an investigation into the city's mayor, Edouard Philippe. Now, he's accused of harassment and misusing public funds, which is something that he's denying. Prosecutors have been investigating a deal linked to the running of Le Havre's Innovation Centre. Now, the reason that this is interesting and the reason it's getting a bit of attention is because he is widely considered to be a likely contender for the 2027 presidential contest in France. So, a lot of eyes on him. But it sounds like from the report that the person making this claim against him was some sort of possibly some disgruntled ex-employee. So there's a lot to unpack here. We don't quite know what's going on, but he's in the midst of this kind of under the spotlight, I suppose, with this police investigation.
Well, one way to disgruntle employees is to contact them outside of working hours. Now, California is considering making this illegal. And I just, before we talk about that, I mean, you and I both work in media. I was talking to the producer of this programme at 10 o'clock last night, and and she would have had every right to contact me at 4:30 this morning too.
I love this story because it doesn't really speak to the kind of modern times, does it?
Yeah.
In terms of, you're right. I mean, we're sort of 24/7. You get WhatsApp messages, etc. Especially when you live in a global world, you have friends all over the world or colleagues all over the world. But I suppose there is an important point here, which is that it can be exhausting to have to be on all the time, answering messages all the time. So yeah, this is it's a lawmaker in California who wants to make it illegal for your boss to contact you outside of your normal working hours, unless it's an emergency or about your working schedule. They're calling it the legal right to disconnect. I only wish I could do that with my kids too sometimes as well. And actually, what they're suggesting is a $100 fine per offence. apparently there's already similar laws in places like Canada, Australia, Portugal. There's been some research into this apparently, which says that more than half of us respond to messages outside of our working hours from our employer. I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all.
I mean, it's also what field you're in, isn't it? I mean, in media, you have to be available if you've got live shows.
Yeah, and you know, when situations are changing, I mean, there must be so many companies. I think one of the things they're pointing out with this is that it's partly post-COVID, and with the kind of, you know, the way we use tech now in our homes, and we've constantly got, you know, Zoom or FaceTime or WhatsApp. It's made us all contactable all the time in a way that perhaps we weren't previously, and a way that we've come to see it as acceptable in a way we didn't previously. And maybe there does need to be a bit of a redressing of the balance.
Yeah. Just before you go, there was a lovely story in the New York Times, and it's about two guys who know a good stick when they see one. They've built a sizable online community by critically reviewing sticks.
You know what? I'm here for that.
Me too.
My kids would be as well. And, you know, they're often come back from a walk with sticks in hand, which get piled up outside the front door. So, you know, I can understand he's probably found quite a niche area, but one that he's not alone in.
Exactly. Catherine, thank you very much indeed. That's Catherine Carpenter. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Russian drones hit high-rise apartment blocks and private homes early this morning in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, killing at least four people, including rescue workers, in a repeat strike at the site of one attack, officials said. Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz has called for early elections, piling pressure on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his increasingly unpopular right-wing coalition. Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has repeatedly ruled out early elections, which opinion polls suggest he would lose. And the number of people injured in Wednesday's 7.2 magnitude earthquake in eastern Taiwan has now climbed past 1,000, though the death toll remains steady at 9. The shake was the strongest in the region in 25 years. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Israel is facing accusations it's violated international humanitarian law in its war with Hamas in Gaza. Health officials in Gaza say at least 32,845 Palestinians have been killed, many of them civilians. Despite the fact that senior US officials have criticized Israel over the high civilian death toll, Washington gives $3.8 billion in annual military assistance to Israel, and the administration has so far resisted calls to condition any arms transfers, and it's also considering an $18 billion arms transfer package that would include dozens of F-15 aircraft. Here in the UK, the government is also under pressure to stop arming the country, with objections mounting up following the death of seven humanitarian aid workers. Well, joining me is Yossi Meckelberg, who's Associate Fellow at Chatham House and a lecturer in International Relations at the University of Roehampton. Lovely to have you back in the studio, Yossi. As you say, yet another fun conversation.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah.
I wonder if you could give us more detail on Washington's arms arrangements with Israel and the further deal that's being considered.
I think when we hear about the possibility of limiting selling arms from different countries, and Canada, Japan, Spain, and some other countries already stop supply, the main supply of weapons in air is the United States, around 70%. Germany is around 30%. So if you look at what can have influence, you're looking at the United States. In the case of Germany, it's mainly submarines. So the United States is, the rest is more symbolic. But at the same time, it's also to strike a balance. No one wants to weaken Israel to the point, because we saw what happened in October 7. We see what happened in the border with Lebanon, the Hezbollah, that has more than 100,000, probably 150,000 rockets and missiles, and already targeting towns and cities and villages in Israel. So in the grand scheme of things, you want an Israel that is strong enough also to balance Iran. But at the same time, you don't want to allow Israel to use this weapon to do what it, you know, what it does right now in Gaza. And I'll give you just one example. There is a bomb that it's, you know, MK-84. I know it's very boring, all these details, but it's one-ton bomb and can flatten a block of flats easily when it's dropped by an airplane. And it's used in Gaza, and it has been used in Gaza. So you can make some provisions when you supply, or either stop supplying this kind of weapons, or make provision conditions that you can't use it in center under certain circumstances. And this is missing in the relations between Israel and the United States when it comes to the supply of weapons. And it needs to change. And actually, until the war in Gaza, I can't say that Israel always used it responsibly and sensibly, but what we see right now, when the ICJ talks about a plausible risk of a genocide, this is changing the game.
What about the UK? What do we supply, and is that going to change? The government is coming under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, let's put it in context. If you just mentioned 18 billion, the UK supply system, which was, according to the defence minister only recently in parliament, to the tune of £42 million. This is very small. So we are talking more about the symbolic side, the same way that, for instance, the Netherlands decided, or the Corder actually ordered the government not to supply parts for F-35. So it's more symbolic. It's more a political stand. We don't want to associate ourselves as European countries with what is happening in Gaza, because there is no, the Security Council calls for a ceasefire, but then the United States says it's unbinding, and 10 days later the war is still raging. When aid workers are killed, when humanitarian aid is not entering. And I think we also need to mention that, there are still hostages in the hands of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and this is separately negotiated. But so there are violations of human rights all around. But when we got to the level of, as the ICJ suggestion, there is a risk of genocide. When the killing is ongoing, there is a risk of starvation, if not already starvation there. Then countries need to make a stand and try to make Israel to see sense, because I think what happened in this war, Israel entering this war in the way that no country should enter, with more will for revenge and rage than strategic thinking. It's never a good way to enter a war, and even worse, no exit strategy. So this can rage. It's an open-ended war with more and more casualties as a result of it. And I think what we see with the arms supply, it's a way to pressurize Israel, but also help probably Israel to save itself from itself.
And is it the responsibility of other countries to halt their arms deals in order to assist peaceful resolution of conflict?
But yeah, first and foremost, we can talk about the arms deal generally. It's a bit, when there is money, some people will supply weapons. And we know that as much as, for instance, post-1945, everyone talked about nuclear weapons and the proliferation of nuclear weapons, most people killed in conflicts were by AK-47s and other small arms. There is a real issue of proliferation of arms, the availability of arms. President Eisenhower already in 1960 warned about the power of the arm industry in the United States and elsewhere, how it distorts policies. We are talking more than 60 years later, and if it's even worse, because it's great jobs. Even if the United States, if you look at the issue of when you make conditions when it comes to the supply of weapons, this is a huge industry. So on the one hand, there is pressure on President Biden to at least limit the supply of weapons. On the other, from the arms industry, it makes more money. It creates more jobs. So there is a counter pressure to do that too. I think what happens right now in Gaza, but it's not. It's what happened in Ukraine, what happened in Ethiopia, what happened in other places in the world, should make us think about all the issue of conflict and deal with root causes of conflict, and what the arm industry does actually to encourage conflict and the result of it, the loss of many innocent lives.
Yossi, thank you very much indeed. That's Yossi Meckelberg there. You're with Monocle Radio. Now, the future of our urban environments is a wide-ranging issue that spans economic, climate and societal corners of the globe. As developers, investors and tenants alike push for more sustainable buildings and for decarbonisation, those tasked with building our future cities have a busy time ahead to ensure we're doing it right. One such firm is global consultancy group McKinsey, who are working to make buildings more valuable by making our urban environment more sustainable. This was the starting point for a conversation between Monocle's editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, and McKinsey's Ben Dimson and Jules Barker. Andrew began by asking Ben about the push and pull they face when tackling this scenario.
We're in a moment of really profound structural and cyclical change happening at the same time. So on the cyclical side, you've got sort of interest rates, you've got inflation. On the structural side, you've got a change of expectations, the way buildings are used. You've got a change of making buildings much more about sort of operations and about customer centricity. It's really a moment in time where a lot of the investors, operators are having to rethink what they do and what their purpose is and how they add value. We talk about profitable decarbonisation. What we mean by that is really systematic, thoughtful interventions about green energy supply, often generated on site through things like solar panels, ground and air source heat pumps, and then demand reduction interventions. And much of that can actually be done in a positive way that makes money. Now, not all of it can, and not every building is suitable. So there's definitely some buildings that are structurally challenged. Some of those are ripe for conversion, but not every building will be. But it creates opportunity as well. There's an upside. We're seeing rental premium, for example. We're seeing, you know, lower insurance costs. We're seeing access to green financing, you know, increased demand from occupiers. So there's two sides to this. This isn't all sort of downside mitigation. There's upside opportunities there as well.
Jules, tell us, when we look at closer to home, you know the London market very well. Could you tell us a little bit, when it begins to boil down to a city, what kinds of impacts this have? What kinds of stories you're seeing unfolding in the market?
Much of the answer to this is that all of these decisions are coming much, much more hyper-local. So we're moving into a world where it's less about finding what is the city doing versus the West End, but there are really specific micro opportunities to be found everywhere. As you were asking earlier, you know, who's going back into the market? When do you go back into the market? There are opportunities out there, but you have to be better than you were before to be able to capture it. You know, in a world where there isn't quantitative easing going on, where rates are going up, you have to be much, much faster, better informed to find and target the right opportunities. But then you also have to operate them in a way that you perhaps didn't have to quite so much before. So as Ben was saying, we're moving from a world where going from just being investors to having to be investors and operators to really, because of the need to decarbonize and to improve assets, going to be investors and operators and developers all at the same time. And so success is less about, is now the time for London, is it West End, is it the city, and more about where is the specific asset when it comes to market, identifying it and jumping on it, and knowing how you, as an investor, operator, developer, are going to turn that into value.
Tell us about some of the micro trends in London, because, you know, we've spoken to developers across the last year who've said things like, we were betting on the tech players even 18 months ago. They're changing how they're working. Maybe they don't want the floor space anymore. They're renting offices that maybe they can get like a quarter of their staff in on an average day. And those ones that are in London are now thinking about, maybe you want to be in the West End, actually, rather than in some Silicon roundabout. Even there, there's been a shift in what people did. Are you seeing those small shifts in every industry where life sciences want to be, where tech wants to be, where real estate wants to be? Can you sniff out some of those trends as you look at the city?
Talking about the different types of operators is really key to this. Historically, you could develop an office in a fairly generic sense, lease it out for 10, 15 years, put a lick of paint on it, and lease it out in a similarly generic sense for another 10, 15 years, and it sort of didn't matter who you were leasing it to. Now, as a developer and as an operator, you need to really understand who your target market is for that office, because a life sciences operator, to use your example, wants something completely different from a bank, who wants something completely different from a tech company. And this is again putting a lot of pressure on the industry, because in a world where you're now leasing stuff for more like 5 years than 15 years, when after that leasing break and you have a new tenant, they're likely to want a very different makeup of office. That's putting increasing pressure on the refurb capex cycle as well.
You're in a fascinating world where there's hard economics on one side, and then there's how people behave, there's sentiment, there's harder to judge things on the other side. You mentioned earlier that actually there are lots of places where retail is thriving. What are the social trends that you're seeing kind of bump into your macroeconomic trends?
If you look across the different asset classes, people are still people that actually enjoy social interaction, don't want to do everything on a video screen. And so if you think about buildings as a place to bring people together and create interactions, sociability, happiness, productivity, I think those are quite fundamental. And what I think has happened coming out of the pandemic is everyone has been a bit more thoughtful around what those attributes are and how you generate them. So whether that's in sort of co-living examples where you have social spaces that people interact, whether that is in offices where they're really rethinking why there is an office and the purpose of it. One of my clients has this phrase around sort of earning the commute. And so I really like that. What do I need to do to persuade people? It's worth spending half an hour, even an hour and a half to come into this space, and what are they going to get from it? And it's elevated the thinking from real estate just being a cost to being actually a key lever of business productivity and business performance.
Ben Jimson there, and earlier Jules Barker from McKinsey in conversation with Monocle's Andrew Tuck. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Well, it's time now to talk trade and economy with economist and former joint head of the UK government's economic service, Vicky Price, who joins us down the line now. Good morning to you, Vicky.
Good morning.
So we're looking at slightly higher than anticipated inflation and jobs in the last couple of months. How is that influencing the Federal Reserve?
Well, we've heard from the head, Powell, just yesterday, and he was being cautious, but in fact, he didn't say exactly what you're suggesting, that both inflation at about 3.2% and jobs job growth have been slightly higher than had been thought to be the case, but there are therefore risks still on the inflation outlook. But nevertheless, what he was hinting at is that he and the other members of the committee that are going to decide on interest rates were probably inclined to see still a cut coming through pretty soon, but of course everyone expects that maybe not before June, which is what the markets have been anticipating really for quite some time. So he was cautiously hinting that things were moving towards normalization in interest rates, which is good news. The markets, of course, have, as I said, anticipated, but have already adjusted yields in a certain way, and we've seen that, of course, being reflected everywhere. For the world as a whole, what happens in the US and what decisions the Fed makes are very important, really, because the others are going to follow. So we're expecting then both the UK and, of course, the ECB to do the same. And we've already seen some other central banks deciding to do that even before that, but that's in smaller countries. But it is quite an important indicator when Powell looks quite relaxed about it, despite the fact he kept saying, yes, of course, there are risks on the upside as well, and risks on the downside too. Maybe we may overdo it if we don't cut rates soon, that things might turn the other way, so we might jeopardize economic growth. So I think all the hints were that indeed we're going to see a cut. I think that's what the markets are deciding, and I think that's what all the other central banks are also thinking is going to be the case.
Because the ECB meets next week, so what do we expect to come from that?
Well, when I say soon, I don't really mean immediately, because of course it's really June that everyone is looking at as the likely a month when it's all going to happen. But there is a lot more reason why the ECB should be reducing rates and should be reducing rates sooner than others. Yes, of course, they're still about 1 point below where they are in the US and where they are in the UK. But what we're seeing in Europe is that inflation is really slowing down. We've had Germany, for example, producing some really interesting data on inflation. If you look at the national measure of inflation, it's going down to just 2.3%. If you look at the one which is harmonized across Europe, 2.7, but clearly below 3, and yes, a little bit above 2, but we are so close to the target rate, and loads of other countries are also seeing that decline happening. And the overall flash estimate for the EU for March is about 2.4%, which is quite low. It means that it's been consistently below 3% now for a while. And that, of course, justifies, I think, a drop in rates in Europe even sooner, but we're still not going to get it because, as I said, we're going to wait for the Fed first, I'm afraid, because what the markets might think about the Europe in particular, if Europe cuts first, of course, it weakens the euro, and then, of course, that means perhaps more inflation in the future. But frankly, there's a lot of concern about growth in Europe right now. If you look at, for example, the composite indicator of activity in Germany, I mentioned the inflation rate coming down. We've got still below the 50 mark, which means contraction in Germany. Yes, services doing slightly better, but in fact, manufacturing declining at a faster rate than it has done for some time. And those are the data for March, the early data for March. So that's a real, real worry. If Germany continues to suffer, then other countries are affected too. But can I just add very quickly before you ask me about what happens elsewhere in Europe? We've got quite good data for Spain, quite good data for Italy, quite good data for Greece, where manufacturing in all those three countries is in fact increasing while it's dropping faster in Germany.
Energy prices, there's worries about that as oil's going up again.
Yes, and of course that's one of the risks which are looked at by the central banks. What we've seen, of course, is in the meeting that took place yesterday, OPEC Plus have decided to continue with their production cuts to the end of this current quarter, the second quarter of 2024. They're going to decide sometime in June, very early June. I think the meeting is on June the 1st, what to do next and whether to extend that. But what this has meant is we've seen that actually at the pump. We're driving around petrol prices, oil prices going up. And in fact, when you look at Brent crude, it's hovering just below $90 a barrel, which is quite high by comparison to where it's been in the last few months.
And various countries are cutting their respective crude oil production.
They are, which is really the way that this cut is going to be effective, of course, in terms of pushing prices up, and also not just production but also exports. But among the countries that are cutting it, that includes Russia, which is of course a contributor to OPEC Plus. And if you add it all together with what's going on in the Middle East, and you find that indeed the cut is quite effective. It's reflected in the prices now. But on the other hand, what you've got is the beginning of milder weather. Not that the winter has been particularly harsh in Europe in particular. Milder weather means that perhaps less demand, and we've seen that less demand being reflected, for example, in what's going on in manufacturing in Germany right now.
Vicky, thank you very much indeed. That's Vicky Price there, and you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Finally, today, Maurice Kondé, the giant of Caribbean literature, died this week at the age of 90. Born in Guadeloupe, she lived in New York, various West African countries, most notably in Mali and in France. The author of more than 20 novels enjoyed international acclaim, winning many awards, including the New Academy Prize, which stood in for the Nobel in 2018. Well, Will Forrester is translation and international manager at English Pen, which is, of course, the writers' human rights organisation, and has a wonderful job organising all sorts of translation events and interviewing authors from all over the world. And Maurice Kondé was one person that you actually did sit down with.
Yeah, we spoke in the middle of the pandemic in 2020 for English Pen's magazine, Pen Transmissions, just as she'd published her penultimate book. And, you know, Maurice was inimitable and had such a long career behind her. And, you know, you sit down with her and, yes, you're talking about a book, but you're also talking about decades of history. Mm. She was, you know, incredibly political in her way, incredibly interested in justice. But above all, she was a great storyteller and incredibly amusing in doing so.
Tell us more about her work.
I mean, she was prolific, as you said. Her novels, great novels of the Caribbean, are, I think, what bring most people to her. her work in the 80s was, you know, big epics of particularly colonial history, but always interested in the individuals behind that. She was, you know, someone who would always upend received ideas of literary and cultural histories. And her later works were similarly enormous, ambitious projects. Her last book, which was published last year in translation by Richard Philcox, her husband, was a great take on the Jesus story. You know, it was that sort of size and ambition of work. But I think that idea of the individual always was at the heart of her work.
Mm. She's known as a Caribbean writer, but of course a lot of her work was influenced by her time in West Africa, particularly in Mali.
Yeah, it was. Her fiction, but also her non-fiction. She wrote an extraordinary, compelling memoir of her time there. And it was, a complex time for her. She's spoken elsewhere about how West Africa, having grown up in Guadeloupe, as she says, a spoilt child, she called herself when we spoke, shielded from histories of colonialism and slavery. She went to Paris, to France for her education, and was confronted by those histories and the racial injustices of the contemporary moment. And she talks about the romantic idea of West Africa she had. She went there and that was shattered. She found herself, I suppose, in between spaces. And that comes through in her fiction as well. Even her first work is you might call it autofiction. It's, you know, a thinly veiled fictionalized memoir of that time.
Mm. You mentioned she grew up in Guadeloupe. She was the youngest child of a large family. Mm. Tell us a little bit more about her life.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, she travelled across spaces, across histories, across languages.
And she came across many huge kind of cultural and political icons, didn't she?
She did, and particularly in that time when she was in West Africa, you know, she was mixing with great writers like Maya Angelou. She had, contact with great activists and political activists. But again, I think she was, you know, uncompromising and complex in her relationships with them as well. That same interest in the nuances of individuals and the breaking down of binaries of good and bad, moral and immoral, right and wrong, I think, you know, that also came through in her time with people. Leila Slimani, who was a great fan of hers, wrote a wonderful, I suppose, testimony to her in The Guardian yesterday. And there she spoke about how Maurice was always upending your ideas of her and was in ways disappointing precisely because she would challenge, you know, expected norms of what was good. And as Leila says, you know, that's what we need in our times. That's what we need in a writer.
And what would you say her legacy is?
I think her legacy is, of course, her work, which speaks for itself. But also, I think, a legacy of Caribbean literature and contemporary Caribbean literature, of engagement with the political and social history of the last half a century, particularly in the Francophone. She wrote in French as someone who would challenge and trouble ideas of what contemporary French literature was, as something that was middle class, often male, often metropolitan. You know, she worked at, unpicked all of that. But also she was someone who would always push against all of those labels. You know, she was bigger than any of those tags that we might be able to give to her.
And of course, this wonderful humour and satire.
Yeah, I mean, when we spoke 4 years ago now, she said, you know, you have to make jokes for people to take you seriously, because that's what life is like. It is full of severity and it is full of comedy. And particularly in her fiction, you see that. We spoke about who can be satirised. And her answer was everyone. Everything can be a source of satire. Always with a compassion and a hope and a joy. She was incredibly hopeful, I think, in her work. But she saw the value not only in and of itself of comedy, but in affecting change and in getting people on your side. I think that was utterly compelling.
Will, thank you very much indeed. That's Will Forrester from English Pen. And as he says, Transmissions is the magazine where you can read more of his interviews with people like Maurice Conway. That's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Laura Kramer, Carlotta Rabella and Monica Lillis. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. And if books are your thing, Tom Baragwanath is the current guest on Meet the Writers. That's you can download that now. He's a writer from New Zealand. And then coming up this weekend, the Pulitzer Prize winning writer Viet Thanh Nguyen. So that's something to look forward to. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and The Briefing is live at midday in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.